In 2 Samuel 11, David has relations with the wife of another man. She becomes pregnant because of that. He murders her husband, tries to cover everything up. The Lord knew, and the Lord said, verse 10 of chapter 12, "Therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." We are in the aftermath of what David has done. And we are in the portion where David is, his life has been turned upside down. He said in verse 10, "The sword shall never depart from your house." The question is, how would you handle it if you knew the rest of your life, if you knew it, the Lord shall never, the sword shall never, neither would the Lord, but the sword shall never depart from your life as long as you live. For David, this may be something like 30 years at this point. I don't really know how old he is, but something around 30 years, maybe 35, maybe 25, something like that. That's a long, long time. How would you handle it? While you're going through all this weight is crushing you, how would you make it more bearable?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that it's because of something that you did. And so what you need to do is say, "I'm sorry for what I did," and turn around and not do those things again and serve God. That's the only way you could make it bearable.
And while I agree with everything you said, something else at the same time, maybe somebody had a hand up over here. I kind of missed something there. Also, in addition to that, to make it just a little bit more bearable, you could think of the rest that was going to come someday. Revelation 21. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven had passed and the first earth had passed away, and there's no longer any sea. I saw a holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men. He will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And,'" now get this, and listen to this very carefully, "'He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will no longer be any death there, no longer any mourning, any crying, or any pain. The first things have passed away.'" Wow.
I
want to
go there.
Right. Sign me up. This is the exact opposite of the next 30 years in David's life. And all of us, this is the exact opposite. By the way, does this place sound boring to you? No. Not only will we be singing praises to the Lord and seeing him as he is and being like him to some degree, but we're not going to have all of this stuff. That makes it worth it. I want to go there. Now, Hebrews 4, I say up here, look forward to the rest. In Hebrews 4, that doesn't mean look forward to the rest of your 30 years. Although you could if you wanted to, depending on your mindset. That's definitely plausible. But in Hebrews 4, this word rest is used some 13 times in the previous verses. Verse 9, "Therefore, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his." You will be resting from your works. A soldier goes out on a mission. It's a long mission. Days. To us, that might not sound long, but if you're the soldier, that's a long mission. You're gone for days. It's dangerous. You're in the thick of it. You don't have any sleep. You're worried all the time what's going to happen to you, what's going to happen to everybody around you, and you finally get back to base. What do you have? Rest. You go to Afghanistan for 9 months or 12 months or however long, and you come back to the States. And when you land on American soil, what do? You kiss the ground. Why? Rest. And that's nothing compared to what this will be. You look forward to the rest. And I ask the second question, what would you do if you knew the rest of your life would be filled with difficulty, suffering, and pain? And Ethan already answered that. You put your head down and you deal with it. You be faithful in every waking moment. Verse 11, therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest. In fact, David knew something about this. In verse 7, he again fixes a certain day, today, saying, through David, after so long a time, just as been said before, today, if you harden your heart, hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. Look back in verse chapter 3. This is Psalm 95, written by David. Again, today, verse 7. If you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of the trial in the wilderness where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with his generation and said, they will always go astray in their heart. They did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And David writes it, saying this same thing can happen right now. You've got to be faithful. And Ethan pointed something out. Why did all this stuff happen to David? Because he originally left the Lord. He departed from the Lord and sinned. And so here you are. You've got 30 years of difficulty ahead of you. Are you going to leave the Lord again? Knowing the last time you did, you messed up. And that's what created all this. So you don't leave him the next time because it's just going to get worse. You just keep on doing, plugging away, doing what he has said to do. Comments or questions here? Yes.
We do expect this, or we should, right?
Excuse me?
We should expect this, that the rest of our life will be... There's something really bad about the idea of knowing your specific future, because I think in human nature we're all just going to go, that's it, I give up now. We can't face it if we looked at it as a whole. But without knowing the specifics, this is generally what we're supposed to anticipate, that there's no promises that it'll be easy while we're here.
Right.
In fact, it says, and Jesus said, the world will hate you because of me. So we should expect hard times.
We should. You know, we'll not always endure hard times, but even then, that doesn't mean we don't have work. We have work helping others see the light. In fact, the work can be a different... difficult work in easy times. Oh, when everything's going great, does anybody want the Lord? Typically not. Remember, that's Deuteronomy 8. Beware when you go into the land that you don't get all fat. Just never think about the Lord again. So when you go into the land, when you're in surrounded by riches, be very careful. It's a different kind of work, right? Okay. Back in 2 Samuel 18. So far, David has had his daughter raped. He's had a child die in the child's infancy. He's had his son murdered and his second son killed. He should have been killed. But now he's got, this family's just falling apart. Well, this last son, Absalom, David had said to Joab, among others, be gentle with him. And killing through the heart with three spears is not being gentle. So David wanted him to be gentle. He killed him. Joab kills him. Verse 28, Ahimaaz, the runner, the news bearer, said to the king, all was well, and he prostrated himself to the king, before the king, with his face to the ground. And he said, blessed is the Lord God, who has delivered up the men who have lifted their hands up against my lord the king. Verse 31, the Cushite arrived, bringing the same news again. Let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. Then the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered and said, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. If you asked anybody in Israel if this was good news, they would have said, yes. Except for David. Now we understand that David's his father, but that is the problem. Verse 33, David, the king, was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I had died instead of you, Absalom, my son, my son. Then it was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. The victory of the day is turned into mourning for all the people, for the king heard it and said that day, the people heard it and said that day, the king is grieved for his son. So the people went by stealth into the city that day, and the people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. The king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, oh, my son, Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house and to the king and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For you know this day that if Absalom, I know this day, that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, you would be pleased. Now therefore arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil which has come upon you from your youth until now. And here's the short lesson. Never let personal relationships get in the way of God's kingdom. That's what was happening with David. Absalom dies. He's his son. We understand grief, but not when it's in the Lord's kingdom. Do you remember when Nadab and Abihu died? What was Aaron instructed? Do you remember? Don't grieve. Don't go outside the gate and pick up the piecemeal and eat it. Do these things. Don't let personal relationships get in the way. Can you think of any applications?
if there's a Christian whose family members who do not allow him or do not permit him to go to Bible study or whatever. I know I've heard this in other countries. That he's still supposed to go, even if it means he's not with his family anymore.
Right. That's interesting. Why do I have Hebrews 10 up there? It's right, and others, right? Now, I was thinking of a different perspective, but in that case, generally speaking, the person would leave the family and go to a family that would accept him and say, yes, come to church with us. Good point. I wasn't even thinking that. I was thinking something that happens all the time in this country, and that is, hey, next Sunday my parents are coming up from Tennessee, and so I'm not going to come to church because they're going to come up because it's the only time they can come up. You know, they only come up once a year, right? Right. So I'm going to... And what do you teach everybody around when that happens?
It's not important.
My parents, at least one day a year, are more important than God. My friends, what you fill in the blank, right? Any other example situations? What were you snickering about?
You didn't have friends, family,
right?
Marriages. I mean, marriage.
Matthew 18. Anybody know what I'm talking about here? Can you read my mind?
He who loves his father or mother more than me.
Okay. Well, yes, but no, not here. Although, yes, that would be the application. This is, if somebody sins against you, go and tell them. And if they don't listen to you, then hush, hush, because it's your family. Or it's your friend. So, you know, they're my friend. Not at all, right? No, what is...
Yeah, but David's putting his personal relationships ahead of the law of the Lord.
Exactly.
I mean, Joab knew what needed to be done.
Right. Right.
Several times here.
Yeah.
You know, Absalom needs to die.
Right.
Go ahead, do it. Kill him.
Yeah.
You know, I'll deal with David. Then he goes and reproves David. Listen, David, get it correct.
Yeah. And you... Well, go ahead.
Look at the kind of man that David was willing to turn the kingdom over if he could have died in his place.
Right.
Absalom was not.
No. You know, and there's something to be said here. Joab was thinking, and I have never really figured out how to say this very well, but he was thinking like numbers. That is a number, and that number is malfunctioning. Now, The other person thinks, that's my son, my beloved son. And Joab is thinking, that machine is malfunctioning. Take care of the machine. Get rid of the machine. Fix the machine. And that's the way we have to think. Now, that doesn't mean we throw away all of our compassion and our mercy. Save some. I can't even think of it. Jude says, with mercy, right? Right. Acts 2:38. Now, this is more along the lines of what you were talking about a little bit, somewhat of a similar situation. Some people won't become Christians because if they become a Christian, what does that say about all of their friends and family? That they're not. And so they won't do it. Never let personal relationships get in the way of, I have no idea what happened there, God's kingdom. Anything else along these lines? We can come up, yes?
It's interesting to see how when a specific part of God's plan is used incorrectly, how big a stumbling block it can become. The family is the nucleus of every part of society that we've ever known. And there's a bunch of other things that have been introduced that we quickly recognize as being bad too, relationship-wise, whether it's a government or a society or an agency or whatever, that relationship would be bad, I won't go there. But when the family one is the one that's God-given, God-arranged, and we mess with that, we can't recognize we've messed with it, and we still see it as the important thing when it throws us way off track.
Yeah. Recently, I've been listening to this one certain radio station, and they have an advertisement for CNN. I can't remember the guy's name right now. And so it's CNN News, and you know, isn't this impressive what we do? And one of the clips they have is Bill Gates. And the question is, what's the most important thing on earth to Bill Gates? And Bill Gates replies, life. All life is of equal value. See a problem with that statement? Only innocent life is of equal value. Guilty life, what do you do with guilty life? Depends on what the guilt is, but you put them to death, right? So, the whole, our society is messed up on family and life, and they have this, they've taken a little bit of the truth and perverted it and run with it. That's what society does, right? Comments or questions here? Okay, so back in 2 Samuel 19, so the king arose and sat in the gate. And everything works out for that family right there. The king arose and sat in the gate. Behold, all the people saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate. And then all the people came before him. Now Israel had fled to each to his tent. All the people were quarreling throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hands of our enemies and saved us from the hands of the Philistines. But now he has fled from the land, out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? The king sent to Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You are my brothers. You are my bone and flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? Say to Amasa. Now this man is whom Absalom put in charge of the army. When David fled with Joab, Absalom takes the army and puts Amasa in charge. So Amasa here is actually enemy. He's working for Absalom. Absalom's dead. So David says to Zadok, go tell Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so more to me, and more also, if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. This is politics. So he says, we're going to take Joab, just kind of shift him over here, and in order to bring unity to the country, we'll take you and allow you to be the in charge of the army. And what does it say? Verse 14, thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man. So they sent word to the king saying, return, you and all your servants. The king returned and came as far as Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to meet the king and to bring the king across Jordan. He meets Shimei, Mephibosheth, and Barzillai on the way. Wasn't that quick? Verse 40. The king went to Gilgal, and Chimham went with him. And all the people of Judah, half of the people of Israel, accompanied the king. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over, all David's men with them over the Jordan? Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative to us. Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us? But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you. Why did you not treat us with contempt? Why did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back the king? And Judah said, na-na-na-na-na. And then Israel said, na-na-na-na-na back. But the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of men of Israel. Now a worthless fellow happened to be there, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king and from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. And here's a point that Sheba. They were almost together. And here comes Sheba, right? It only takes one rabble-rouser to prevent or ruin a good thing. Remember Diotrephes? Church was a fantastic. Everything was going fantastic there, apparently, except for this one guy who loved to be first. Over in Prague, let me back up. This winter, when Marcy and I were in Alabama, we met with a friend who preaches in Prague. That's where he lives. He's married a Czech woman and all. 20 years he's been there. This congregation is a very exciting congregation to just know about. Well, they were talking with another church in Prague. And they were talking about getting together. Maybe we can assemble. Maybe we can meet together. Maybe like not so long ago happened here. Well, in the midst of all these discussions, I'll tell you who it was. A man, Eflagard Smith, went over and visited over there. And then he came back to the States. But one of the people in the other congregation started saying, No, we can't meet together. So we had basically two churches. We're going to come together and become one church. And because of one person, they decided not to. It only takes one to destroy what otherwise could be a good thing. And so what's the point? May it never be me. May it never be me. Now, I said that Sheba. I've kind of missed something in here, haven't I? Gary, you want to say something?
I don't think any of them are working towards unity very hard.
Right.
Okay, I mean, yeah, David's playing the politician there, trying to, But I mean, we took a person, we said this verse, we said that, it's like, are you guys working towards unity? They're not.
Right.
They're, you said that, I said that.
Yeah, they're children. Yeah. They're children. Can you turn on the top?
It seems like they're kind of scrambling to see who's going to win.
Yeah.
Make sure they're on the right bandwagon when the decision gets made.
What does that sound like? Right. Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. You see what happened there? That mouth. I said that Sheba? True. There's got to be a Sheba involved. It takes two to not tango. Or no, it only takes one not to tango, right? That's the point. That mouth. Oh, the battery's going dead now. 1 Kings 12. We're going to run into this again in just a few weeks now, or maybe a few months, where we go around here, huh? Rehoboam. 1 Kings chapter 12. You remember, Solomon dies. This guy, Jeroboam, is down in Egypt. He comes back when Rehoboam is thinking about becoming king, and the whole tribe is saying, hey, what are we going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Verse 13, the king answered the people harshly. And you know the rest of the story. Next thing we know, this one kingdom was split into two. This mouth of ours, well, the power of our mouth. Proverbs 18:12. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healings. Rash words, like a sword that comes in and cuts what was one into two. And what is that sword? Right here, our mouth. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules a spirit than he who takes a city. Because it's easy to take a city compared to controlling your own tongue. He who restrains his words has knowledge. He who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. He who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from troubles. We're not done. The Bible has a little bit to say about the mouth. A fool gives full vent. That's ESV in the New King James. Mine doesn't say that. Full vent to his spirit. He just pours. Here it comes. And he just lets it go. And you're going to hear everything this person has to say. But a wise man quietly holds it back. Do you see a man who's hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Strive for peace with everyone, and for holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. I didn't even include in this James chapter 3. The short of it is, do not be overcome by what you want to say. Don't be overcome by what you want to say. I'm going to put John Bosworth on the real spot for a second. When Marcy and I drove around, we came back from Hungary, wanted to figure out where we're going to work. We visit here. We stay at the Bosworths. We visit. Marcy and I drive away. We decide, let's come here. The phone call I made to tell John, or one of the phone calls I made to tell him, I called up, and as I'm wont to do, I know I'm putting him on the spot, but don't worry. I say something like, this is Harvey Schwartz calling from the Republican National Committee, and we want to know why you haven't sent in your donation. And let me tell you something. I was introduced to the real John Bosworth. He didn't do anything sinful, I don't think. But I identified he could be this kind of person that might not hold his tongue. I'm talking about him. Let me tell you what I did a few years ago. I was working as I was transitioning from full-time work to becoming a full-time supported preacher. I had a part-time job, and I did not like it. And that was a problem right there. I was not content with the good job that I had. And so one day I had a problem, and there were people in there, and they just didn't work. Nobody knew how to work. And I let everybody know it one day. Was that helpful? Not at all. To this day, I'll never forget it, what I did that one day. And it wasn't loud, but it was aggravated, and out of my mouth came exactly what I was thinking. And it was not helpful for anybody, especially for God. I know I'm one of the people that needs to go home and get down on my hands and knees and pray to God, take this out of me, beat this out of me. I do not want to be this person. Change me. Mold me. Comments or questions here? Sorry, John, thank you. So back in 2 Samuel 20... By the way, first Absalom, then David, then Judah, then Sheba, and then... What's the point? And by the way, it wasn't even first Absalom. Many others before him. What's the point?
There's always going to be somebody that's going to... It's always going to happen.
Satan does not quit. He doesn't quit. That's it. That's the short of it. As a side note, about the upcoming divided kingdom, about 45 years later or so from this... The North-South tensions already exist. We see it here. I mean, they're just... And it has existed ever since the time of the judges. It's always been there. Never North-South. Right?
It started shortly after the division of the land.
Right.
You could start to see it.
Right.
And, you know, I think when the king came, just got... And
it got worse.
Saul, David, Solomon.
Right. In Solomon's time, as wise as he was, he did the brainy thing of... not requiring food from Judah, but from requiring from all the other tribes. Well, no wonder. And he was a taskmaster to all of them too, right? So it's no big surprise that in 1 Kings chapter 12, by the way, if you know something's got potential to be there, then you handle it and walk around it all the more gingerly, right? Instead, here comes Rehoboam, and he uses harsh words. And what do you expect would happen? Okay, back here in 2 Samuel 20. Verse 3, David came to his house at Jerusalem. The king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep the house, placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living at widows, as widows. How sad. Really? Ladies, who wants to live like this? Raise your hand. No, nobody? No takers. How sad. That's what nobody wants to live like that. They weren't married. They weren't even not married. They were just like out there in limbo land, right? If only everyone had followed God's laws. It wasn't even their fault. They're caught in the middle of this, right? So they live. David lives probably another 10 years or so, something like that. They live, I don't know how long it is, but if it's a year, it's too long. They live all this time. How are they supposed to live in all of this time? I'm not asking how are they supposed to live, although you might think that if you were in that situation, but I'm asking, what are they supposed to do? And what's always the answer?
Serve God as best they can.
Serve God as best they can. Be faithful as best they can. Now, can you think of any modern equivalents to this? Right? Any person who is unscripturally divorced, man or woman, any person who is unscripturally divorced, Matthew 5:32, and this is one of the texts we could go to, but it makes the point well enough. Matthew 5:32, I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman who has been divorced for the wrong reason, commits adultery. If the woman left the man or the man left the woman for the wrong reason, it's bad. And what you have here is somebody who is living in a situation where they're deprived. But what are they supposed to do? Live faithfully. That's it. That's the live faithfully, right? What did you tell me about Gary Henry?
Even though he has the right to remarry.
Right. His wife left him. Cheated. He divorced her. He had the right to remarry, but he decided not to make a point that you can live a celibate life. It can be done. So why does he choose to? Why does he sacrifice? Because so many people say, it can't be done. Yes, it can be done. No, nobody wants it for anybody. But that's what God says. And again, how can we avoid it all? If everybody would have just followed God's laws to begin with, everything would be fine. Comments or questions? Anything else? So, the king said to Amasa, go out, call the men of Judah, chapter 20, verse 4. Call them for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Well, Amasa goes and he takes a little bit more time. I have no idea why. If anybody can figure that out, please let me know. So David says, this is going to create a problem. So Joab, he's always one to kill. He goes out and he murders Amasa. Okay. Verse 13. He's chasing Sheba. As soon as he was removed from the highway, that is Amasa, all the men passed after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now he went through all the tribes of Israel, even to Abel, even Beth-Mecha, and all the Berites, and they were gathered together and also went after him. They came and besieged him, this is Sheba, in Abel Beth-Maacah, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city, and it stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. They're trying to tear down this wall so they can get at that person. Now, what is that person trying to do? Do you remember? What is the person trying to do or actually doing? Hiding?
Dividing.
And our New Testament is reject a factious man after a first and second. That's what they're doing here. They are rejecting a factious person. This illustrates how serious. They're ripping down this wall to murder him, or to kill him, not murder. It's treason. They're trying to kill him. But for us, now we're not going to murder anybody, but we take it seriously. My version says factious. Device, yes. Anybody else remember their word? Heretic. That's a transliteration of the word. Like baptism, it's a transliteration of the word. And it means one who holds an opinion. Here's what is interesting. Turn there. Titus 3. This hit me like a two-ton heavy thing one day. Titus chapter 3, verse 2. Reject a factious man after a first and second warning. A factious person is one who initially they're grabbing onto something. They have an opinion. They have an opinion. Now, what they do with the opinion is what makes them factious. They try to divide. Here's the interesting thing. Is the opinion a wrong opinion to have or a right opinion to have? It does not say. Right. Right.
Just what you do with it.
What you do with it. Exactly. You might be the only right one, or there might be only one wrong person. And if you go and say, you've got to change now, guess what you've just done? You've become the factious person. Even though you're right, you're not in the right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, mine says, as for a person who stirs up division.
Right.
So like you said, it doesn't matter if you're the right person or the wrong person. It depends on how you approach it.
Do they know they're stirring up division? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. They might just be driving. It might be heading that way. They don't know it. And so what you do is you say, hey, look what's happening here. Can you see this is going towards division? And the person, if their heart is sincere, will say, I stop now. I'm right, but I stop now. Right? And they approach it some other way. The person who says, I don't care, I'm going to keep on driving, is the one that has to be rejected after a first and second warning. Gary, you have a... Okay. Yes?
So how is this compatible with a situation where there's a situation where you can't let something go because it's wrong?
Yes, this is not talking about something that's wrong.
Okay.
Right. This is neither... In fact, in the scenario, the person was right.
This is red or blue carpet type stuff.
No.
Okay.
Not necessarily. I mean, we have to allow for... People are on different levels. Everybody's on a different level. Everybody's on a different level. Even with other things. Not red or blue. But what this church can do. You know?
So, trying to address something isn't what makes it factious. It's the way you go about it.
Yes.
That makes it factious.
Right.
Whether it's a big deal or not.
Right.
It's going out of way to create a division where one really didn't exist.
Right. Right. Okay. Where am I? So, they're ripping down this wall. Then a wise woman called from the city. I love that. Called from the city. She got on her cell phone and she said, hello, called from the city. Here, here, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you. So he approached her and the woman said, are you Joab? And he said, I am. And she said, listen to the words of your maidservant. And he answered and said, I am listening. Then she spoke saying, formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice in Abel. And thus they ended the dispute. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel, and boy, don't we need more of those people. I am one of those. I am of the group. There are two classes. The people who are unfaithful and unpeaceable, and the people who are faithful and peaceable. And here comes this woman who says that. By the way, anybody can say it, but you will know them by their deeds. A few things about this person who is faithful and peaceable. First of all, she was a woman, which means they let anybody in this club. That's a joke, but it's serious, right? Anybody can be in this. This is not just that golf. Anybody know what golf means?
Gentlemen only,
ladies forbidden. This is not golf. Right. This is open to both genders. You ever notice it says she's peaceable? Often, who is it that keeps the peace in the house? The woman. But lest you get big heads, sometimes women can destroy churches too. So be careful, right? But it is a woman. She's wise. Also, verse 16, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you. She is willing to act, takes initiative, and is courageous. The city's being attacked, and she sticks her head up above the wall. Or metaphorically, right? So he approached her, and the woman said, are you Joab? She wasn't a know-it-all, was she? That's a joke, but it's not, is it? And I say she because it's a she. We're talking about generically somebody who is faithful and peaceable is not a know-it-all, right? Okay, he answered and said, I am. She said, listen to the words of your maidservant. I am listening. And she said, formerly they used to say, they will surely ask at Abel, and thus they ended all dispute. In other words, this town was known for its wisdom that it had. It helps if you're from good stock. That doesn't always happen, but thank God, literally, truly, many of us are from good stock. And even if we're not, our families are not, we are from a culture that is from relatively good stock. How do I know? Go somewhere else and get confronted with the question, you mean it's a sin to lie? And that's when you realize, wow. Not only is that person immature, but I wouldn't have known that unless it's ingrained in our society. You shouldn't lie. It isn't now, for at least, right, for temporarily. And there's more to this good woman. She's concerned for God's people. She says, look, do you want this? Do you want to swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? Do you want to attack this town and destroy your people? Obviously not. She shows no sympathy for anything that goes against God's will. Sheba has risen against God, and she says, I've got an idea. She goes back. She's not afraid of doing, or at least seeing that it is done, whatever needs to be done. She goes back, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it over to Joab. The Lord used a woman to bring about peace in Israel. Women have a privileged position just like men do. She claimed to be peaceable, but yet she is at least involved with the chopping off of a man's head. Don't mess with people, women especially, who say they're peaceable. Is that the lesson? No, that's not the lesson. How can she be peaceable, yet have somebody's head chopped off? How? How do you reconcile the two?
Innocence versus guilt.
Right.
You recognize the difference. I think there's a pretty big element of discretion that she is showing here about how to go about this. She's, have Joab come to me and let's have this little talk instead of shouting back and forth at one another and probably taking a bigger position and creating jealousies on the part of the people that were inside the wall. You know, who she thinks she is.
Right.
Keep it low-key and have a discussion.
get the job done.
Get it straightened out.
She was also peaceable in that, in the greater context, what did she do? She brought about peace of the, as you said, guilt and innocence, right? I think it was guilty. Here's a guilty person that is disrupting the peace. I'm a peaceable person. What do I do? She was thinking, that machine is broken.
Right. You bring peace to God's people.
Right.
That means the evil person has to be put to death. That's
right.
Still bringing peace to God's people. It
right.
has to be done.
Right.
But David would do it.
Right.
A lot of times he would do it.
Yeah.
I mean, Amnon shouldn't have put to death. Absalom shouldn't have put to death. David wouldn't do it.
Amnon, yeah. Adonijah.
This concept is at the heart of almost every foreign policy decision that a country's ever had with itself.
I missed. Say it again.
Can you use peace? Can you obtain peace through violence? I mean, it's just so relevant.
Oh. Okay. So, we have unity again. Do you want to say something? Chapter 21. This is something totally different. The context just completely was disrupted. We have no idea what's going on, other than I'll just throw out my 2 cents for what they're not worth. The famine of the days of David for 3 years. You've read the text, and you know it's because of the sins of Saul. Now, if it had been 35 years since Saul reigned, and suddenly the Lord says, oh, here's a famine for what happened 35 years ago, which all of you have completely forgotten, except for the Gibeonites, it might not have made too much sense, and that's the strongest argument I have. There's a little bit more to it than that. But the general idea is, if this is punishment for something that happened in the days of Saul, then when do you think it happened? Shortly thereafter. David's king, but it doesn't make sense to have been too long. Now, I realize that's man's wisdom. Right. Right. Okay. So David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. By the way, verse 5 says, the man who consumed us and planned to exterminate us from remaining within any border of Israel, assuming that is not exaggeration, and it might be, but assuming he is not, Saul was going for genocide here. That's what he's going for. Get him out of the land. The king called to the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now, the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnants of the Amorites, and the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul sought to kill them for his zeal for the sons of Israel. Remember Joshua chapter 9? The Gibeonites snuck in there under the radar. Okay. Verse 3, thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you, and how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And that's backwards. Genesis chapter 12 didn't say, and in the Gibeonites, all Israel will be blessed. Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, in you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And here he's going to the Gibeonites, who are not Israelites, and saying, what can we do that you will bless us? It's totally backwards. Now here's a question for you. Step back into Saul's day, or whenever this was happening. Okay. Israel had made a covenant with some of these people, and suddenly Israel comes along and decides, oh, we're going to kill them instead. Now, that's what's happening. Now, here's the hypothetical part. Say some people, remember, Israel is the light in the world, and everybody's supposed to look at Israel and say, that's it. And not only is that it, but we want to join them. We want to join them, and suddenly they're killing the people that they've made an agreement with. What good will that do? No good at all. It'll do bad, in fact. Not only will it not do good, it'll do bad. It'll reflect poorly on the Lord. So, if possible, so long as it depends on you, right? We covered that last week. We're going to cover it again this week, right? Sorry to be repetitive. Oh, here's another one. You might not get this one. Give the enemy no occasion for slander. Is that okay? Anybody else? Reproach is what my version says. I'm not sure I didn't look the word up in everybody's, right? Slander, 1 Timothy 5:14. It's talking specifically to women, actually, and about What's the context, guys? You can look at it from chapter 5, maybe. Widows, okay, that's the idea. Don't give them, but the general principle always applies. Never give them the opportunity to reproach God, God's people.
God's name is blasphemy.
Right. Exactly. Have you ever heard that somebody would not become a member of a certain church, or somebody would not become a member of a certain church? Do you know what those people do? Do you know how they treat each other? Have you ever seen them? They're a bunch of meanies. Bad meanies is what my mom used to say. They're bad meanies. Right.
A bunch of wolves trying to attack each
other. Exactly. And we've seen it. You've seen it. You've heard of it. You've seen it. And so the person who's supposed to see the light instead sees a black hole and says, I don't want anything to do with that. Remember, Jesus gave a commandment. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you might also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another, right? If you have love for one another. That's how we're separate from everybody else. And here, in this situation, Israel is killing the people that they made a covenant with. No wonder God has to take care of this. Because he's got to make this clear to all the rest of the world. No. This ain't my idea. I'll punish my people for this. Nowadays, we don't have direct punishment. People don't start falling over in the pews or anything like that. But still, God says, no. We have to act a certain way, or else people will not want to be God's people, won't want to join them. So they take seven. How many of them, by the way? Why seven? I don't know either. But it's another one of these situations where there's seven of them. So they take seven of the descendants of Saul. By the way, if this happened early, it might have been that these people were actually involved in it too. I don't know. That's pure speculation. Not totally unreasonable. And they hung them in Gibeah of Saul, in Saul's house, basically, not literally, you know, but where he's from. And the king spared Mephibosheth because he had made a covenant with Jonathan, saying, I will never, you know, we're partners. verse 10. Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until it rained on them from the sky. This is their mom, the mom of at least two of them. And she's out there for something like 6 months. Out there from April till April, May, June, July, August, September, October. 7 months roughly, okay? She allowed neither birds of the sky to rest on them by day, nor beasts of the field by night. When it was told David that Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had got what she had done, David went and took the bones of Saul, the bones of Jonathan, and all the bones, and buried them where they should be properly buried. It's an interesting story, but there's one lesson that I get out of it. You probably get something else out of it. How long ago had Israel made a covenant with Gibeonites? Hundreds of years. Had the people forgotten? Doesn't matter, does it? Because who had not forgotten? God. I think I asked the question. God takes his people's covenants very seriously. So, pay your taxes, because you live in a society where you have said, I live here and I'm going to pay my taxes. So pay them. Let your yes be yes. Don't owe anybody to anything, anybody to anything, or anything to anybody, right? Don't default on your loans is essentially what it's saying. When we enter into agreements, God is watching, and we are representatives of Him, and so people are watching us and saying, hey, what kind of a person is this guy? Oh, he's the kind of person that never does what he says he'll do. Well, what good is that for the God? It isn't. Comments or questions here?
Honoring your man is, I mean, something else you apply here. It kind of throws in a question of the whole mental divorce concept.
Yeah. nothing like adding to a conversation with ending it at mental divorce. Gary?
You know, the situation with Michael, I know we're here to talk about Michael.
No.
You know, sometimes, you know, you may suffer consequences as a result of something else she said. She suffers terrible consequences here. There was at the hand of her dad's sin.
Yeah.
More than once.
Right, her whole life.
She's like, you know, her whole life is like, oh. I mean, yes, she, you know, she spoke out against David there at one point. And, you know. But, I mean, she suffers greatly.
Yeah.
No fault of her own.
Right.
And that may happen.
Jonathan, somewhat related. Jonathan, his father and king is a nitwit. But yet, what does Jonathan have to do? As long as it's just a matter of opinion. He's got to listen to the nitwit. I mean, talk about difficult. But yet, what does he have to do? And you might be in that situation. Might be your husband, might be your dad, might be somebody else, I don't know. You might be in the situation where the person is clearly not worthy inherently of being in subjection to. But God has said, this is the structure. And you fit in there, and that's where you fit in, so go ahead and do it. The text ended with four descendants or children of, do you remember who being killed, slaughtered? Four giants. One of them was named Goliath. They were all these big people. And so God did it with David. God did it four more times here. And so, what do we understand? God can do it anytime he wants to. So if you have a Goliath of a problem, who do you go to? God, because he can help you. Any other comments or questions? You've listened well. And you've contributed well. Thanks for your work. Who has...